Okay, we'll do our introduction first. For those of you here for the first time, these are just some Sanskrit mantras we're going to recite, which make the atmosphere very clear and purified. Please turn to page 1. Even if you don't know what it means, don't worry. I'll just do it. Om Agyanatirmanandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurum Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manopishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Swaparantikam Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Uttapada Kamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavamsha Sri Rupam Sagajatam Sagana Raghunatam Vitantam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Bhadam Sagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamsha Hey Krishna Karna Sindho Dina Bandha Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Rishabhanu Sutta Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakopatanubhyascha Tripa Sindhubhya Evacha Padidanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namah Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadara Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Every once in a while I find something very interesting we can put on the board and everyone can have a go at. I was curious what you all thought of that. What do you say? There are no clear and final answers. There are only discussions and thoughts and silent wonder filling each moment. Is anyone touched in a particular way by that?
Would you
care to explain a little bit?
I just always sort of felt that there's no black and white, there's no clear answers to anything. It's always a scale.
You wouldn't mind me asking you? You're pretty clear about that?
No.
Now, maybe you could explain for all the people out there in TV land how one might. I was always curious, how do you live your life according to this? I know a lot of people, many people, they identify with this. I always try to understand. So how do you how do you actually, how does one live in that way?
Well, that's the part of my life that I'm open to change one moment to the next and try and enjoy the moment as much as I can.
And then?
Which one is? It just goes on and off.
Now, of course, what I think, I can see that the body is changing. I mean, certainly you remember when he was a little baby. Certainly he's changed. Okay, and so one moment's going after another. But I always thought that there's some final changes of this present body.
Some final changes. You're asking me, I don't sort of see what you mean by that.
Well,
I mean, it's changing all the time.
But might there not be a visible end to this body?
Not sure.
And so, then, how do you go from moment to moment after that?
Sure. Spiritual.
Alright, now you really got me mystified.
And so?
You're the first one I've met who's admitted that quickly. You've come to the right place. So, spiritually, you go on and on. Now, it seems that we have to try to understand more what that means. And that might mean we have to get some clear and almost final answers.
It's probably the trick of me. Yeah.
Probably what?
It's probably the trick that I'm, you know, that Russell would have here.
Mm-hmm. I see. Anyone else? So, you find some? What do you say?
Well, just after looking at it before, I sort of thought maybe it's everything is a matter of your perception relative to your person, your being at the present at that time.
Mm-hmm. Everything.
Yeah.
So how do you live your life in terms of that principle?
Your actions, like in the present, are sort of a reflection of all the experiences that have built up for that moment.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't really delved too deeply into it myself, so it's still pretty
much. Anyone else?
It's like everyone's got different opinions, and you've got to compromise, and then you've got to end up doing what you feel is right for yourself.
And how do you figure out what's right for yourself?
Keep discussing with other people. And then this is the final answer.
That's the final answer, huh?
No. That's what we're trying to do.
There's no final answer, you say. So I asked if that's the final answer.
No, because tomorrow I might find something different to help me think more about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll add to that fancy.
And then?
And then I'll discuss with someone else and see what they think. And then hopefully they know more to help me.
And then?
Then you go into deep thought and go into a camel.
Can we give the lady a seat? Is that all you do? deep thought and comas and discussion?
It's what I think of now.
I mean, is that your whole day?
No.
What are you mainly doing during the day?
Trying to stay happy.
Mm-hmm. And how do you do that?
By not getting into people's way in there.
So the whole day you spend not getting in people's way. That's your prime occupation?
Not that. So I'm constantly thinking, hopefully thinking about what the other person's feeling, or thinking if it's going to hurt their feelings if I say something bad or something good. Or I thought that's going to help them when they end up crying or something.
So you don't do anything else besides this?
No.
It's all you do all day long?
And work.
Ah, what was that last thing?
Work.
Ah.
Well, that's what I'm thinking.
So there is, you have some final things you have to do, right?
Well, every day is going to be a different question.
But how many days of the week do you go to work?
5.
So every day has a different question, but 5 of those days, the activity is the same. You see my point? Every day, does anyone catch that point here? Every day, he's saying he has a different question. But I'm pointing out that 5 of 7 days, he's doing the same thing. So maybe things aren't so different. What would you say as an experienced man in this world?
Well, in my experience, I totally agree. You have no clear and final answers.
That's clear, huh?
That's clear to me. But that's not to say that there isn't an answer. And for me, myself, I've had to make a jump into another dimension that only requires an act of my will. And I call that faith in a power greater than myself. So it's made it, for me personally, searching for this clear and final answer. I've taken that step to somehow make that unimportant towards my life personally. Based my life on 3 basic units at this stage in my life, and the first one is that I've come to admit and accept that I'm powerless over certain situations in my life, and that my life is unmanageable by me. And my second basic premise for me is that I've come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore some sort of sanity to me as a person and my life as I lead it today. And the third one is that I try on a daily basis to hand my will and my life over to the care of my higher powers, I understand. And just by doing those sort of things is what I base my life on today.
How would we get more information about this higher power, those of us who would be interested in that kind of thing? Wouldn't that be a good question?
For me, it comes from within. It's on a spiritual basis.
Oh, now you're mystifying me just like he did. Yeah. You're losing me.
Yeah.
Stop using those big words.
Yeah. Well, I have no explanation for it. I think in the acts of accepting and doing those certain steps for me is access me into something that has no explanation for anybody who does not partake of it.
Something that has no explanation for anyone who does not partake of it. Anyone else? Any other comments? Have you any? Yeah?
I think there's an answer for everything if you follow the right instruction from any saintly person. And as you're more inquisitive to gain better knowledge, you refer to a more high authority.
I wonder, when, I'm sure some of you have computers at home, some of you have some kind of appliances, yes, even a stereo, yes, or something, right? You must have something, right? Everybody has got something, yes? In your car, you got something? Got one of those big, those big systems in your car?
Oh, an energy of the car.
But you got something, right?
Yeah.
So doesn't everything come with an instruction manual? Now, do you say, well, there's no clear and final ways to deal with this new gadget I have? We can discuss it, think about it, and be silent, and let the wonder fill each moment. Is that the way you approach your new device, your new computer, or your new stereo system? Does anybody do that?
You should play with it and see what works, what doesn't.
And after you get confused, then what do you do?
You learn from the mistakes, what's the right thing to learn, what's the right.
You read the manual after a while.
Yeah,
not at first. After a while you read the manual. Why do you do that? Because you're afraid of destroying your machine, right?
Yeah.
Mm. But one thing we might notice is interesting, we as individuals don't have any fear about possibly destroying our lives, you know. It's like kind of just, you just take it as it comes. I notice that people don't have a real driving determination to find some set principles and set standards. Now suppose those of you who work, or even those of you who go to the university or school, suppose your employer or your teacher treated you in this way. When it comes time for your paycheck, he says, there are no clear and final answers. There can only be discussion and thoughts and silent wonder filling each moment. What would you say? Huh? You have any employers here, everybody? Everybody knows what it's like to work, so suppose when it's time to get your check, that's the answer you get. Will anyone here be satisfied? Or anyone going to the uni here? Or going to school? So suppose your teacher, you know, when it comes time for you to get your grade, the teacher just tells you, you know, we're not going to give you your diploma or your certificate or whatever because there's no clear and final answers.
Well, it would be quite sort of opposite, really.
You right?
It would be quite opposite,
really.
Opposite, appropriate. Because that's what it comes down to.
Oh, but yeah, I see what you mean. Of course, I remember when I was in university, it was during the countercultural years, and the students, we were always on the lookout for courses where a teacher was really trying to be different and radical, and he would let you make up your own grade. So, I remember I took one philosophy course about higher consciousness. So, you know, the teacher said, okay, now you all just give yourself a grade according to, you know, where you think you're at. Well, of course, I said, I deserve honors. No doubt about it. Clear, definite. So, my point is, can't we see that although we may be mentally attracted to this notion, when it actually comes to living, we want clear, definite things? How many of you here have girlfriends or boyfriends? Anyone? Who? No one. Okay, any case, let's pretend you did. Well, the crowd is definitely different. So, suppose, you know, you're trying to make some definite progress with your girlfriend or boyfriend, and whenever you ask a question, you always get the answer, you know, there's nothing clear and final. You get quite frustrated after a while, wouldn't you? Because relationships are about building up some kind of definite guidelines and procedures. So once again we see that although we say these kind of things, we don't act that way. Suppose the government of New Zealand began to treat you all like this.
I knew someone was going to say that.
When it comes down, but when it actually comes down to getting services and things like that from the government, getting protection from the government, suppose that was completely the answer, 100%. You'd say, what's the use in paying, you know, paying our rates, right? What are we getting in return? Of course, you're saying that now, but at least you'd be getting a little something. Suppose every time you went to the social benefits office, or you went, whatever, and you, all you were told is, there's no clear and final answers. It's just the wonder that fills every moment. So my point is, it's quite obvious that we live our life in a very definite way. You know, why is it when it comes to deciding what we should do and what the standards are, then everything becomes indefinite? Why is that?
I think what leads on from this is that yes, that's unequivocally pretty accurate what is on the blackboard. But of course the leap, the great leap forward that people are in a dilemma about is to what? And they do not want to be sucked in by dogma. Because there's lots of dogma out there which will fill all that up.
Okay, the D word. Very popular these days.
Well, I mean dogma. I mean whether it's philosophical, religious, political, or whatever. People want structures. But they're also very, very hesitant about embracing a lot of things. Because this is the idea of cynicism.
I see them embracing a lot of things.
Well, they do. Yeah, only to embrace other things in another 6 months' time. And the level of the stupidity of those sort of people is often closely accompanied by the fact of how often they change their minds.
So, now this word dogma, everyone has used that word. Have you used that word before?
Yeah.
You've used that word?
Oh, it's better than before.
Everyone. Thank you. Well, what does it mean to you?
I don't actually know the definition of it.
Well, just take a stab at it.
Sort of rough guess or
whatever. Yeah. It's not an English test. What would you say it means?
It means to me it means a set of words defining the belief system.
Yeah, okay. And you?
That pretty much comes in.
I didn't say that. A belief system. Now, what are your feelings about Bhagavad Gita? Any of you a little bit familiar with Bhagavad Gita?
Well, the phrase I always come back to with this discussion is religion without philosophy is dogma. Philosophy without religion is speculation.
Can you expound upon that, please?
Well, it's sort of there in a nutshell, but I could repeat it.
All right. Did everyone catch what Grant said here?
I suppose if I could expand on it. I mean, what the trap that you can fall into, I think, is that sort of you take on board a dogma, a religion, or whatever, which has got a set of rules, and you sort of close yourself off, blink yourself off, and rigorously follow those things. And that just becomes dogma, really, without any real intelligence. But if you put philosophy with it, philosophy which can stand the rigors of being argued and counter-argued and what have you, you're starting to get somewhere. But if you just have philosophy by itself, without the underpinning of the religion and the ritual and, I don't know what you call it, without that, we often end up with speculation. And everybody out there speculates about money, about politics, about religion and what have you. But they don't really know, because they've never read anything, say, like the Bhagavad Gita, they've probably never read anything like the Bible. So it's all sort of, you know, speculate. But without any real grounding through great ancient texts, for instance, so it just becomes, the philosophy just becomes speculation. So I always think if you've got to have religion and philosophy coupled together. Can't just have, you know, the one or the other. I mean, it's a very rough way of putting it, but it starts to get us somewhere. Yeah. Sorry, David, I mean, I might be off the track, but
it's your Well, in New York, we'd say if you're at a, you know, because when the payphone used to cost a dime, we'd say it's your dime.
No, no, it's your glass.
No, it's your glass. So, anyone notice how people, if you go out, if you just walk down the stairs to Broadway and look up and down the street tonight on a Friday night, my point is you're going to see a lot of dog mouth there, just like he was saying. Now, what are you actually going to see? You're going to see people with their blinders on who have beliefs that the goal of life is to satisfy the body and to relieve the aching of the mind, and they don't want to think about anything more than that. They want to be entertained, they want to be stimulated. That's it. If that can happen, they consider it a great Friday night. Now, isn't that dogma? What is it?
I'm trying to get made around it.
You got certain beliefs.
Yeah. It's a dogma of materialism.
You have certain beliefs. I am this body. I want to enjoy. And enjoying means I need some good sensations for my skin and some entertainment for my mind. If that happens, great. I'm focused on that. You notice if you go out there, the people are completely focused. They're going towards McDonald's or KFC or the cinema. You know, they're concentrated. And they have beliefs. Wouldn't you say so?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. A lot of people are pretty materialistic in the...
You use that. What does that mean now, materialistic?
Seeking is often from a pretty shallow sort of sources, what you're saying, going to the movies or going to McDonald's, satisfying those.
Shallow, you say? That's shallow. Now, what's deep?
Was warm, yeah.
You know how to get off the hook pretty easily. Okay. So, what I'd like us to meditate on is that, please remember, while saying that there's no clear and final answers, so on and so forth, we live our life in a very clear and final way. We've got things to do, goals to achieve, places to go, people to meet, right? Isn't that definite? Isn't that clear? And the reasons behind all that, those form our dogma, our belief system, right? Everyone agrees with that? Or no? You've gotten around that one yet? No. Yeah. What's yours?
I'm getting around it.
Yeah. Okay. It would would seem that if we're going to take up a spiritual pursuit, we just can't believe. We have to have a system of verifying, of experiencing. That, to me, separates the blind following from the actual rare calling. If you can actually get a chance to verify, to experience, then you're into something. Now, I've said it before, I don't know if I've said it here, but in the Bhagavad Gita, nowhere will you find Krishna saying, just believe in me. You'll never find one verse like that, just believe. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains spiritual science and always gives you procedures to verify and experience what is being said. In other words, first you hear, and then you apply your senses according to what you hear, and you get the experience. Now, isn't that fair enough? Well, you tell me. What more would you like to see? Does that sound fair enough to you?
That sounds fair enough to me.
Yeah. So, the whole point of Bhagavad Gita is simply to get you to hear and then apply your senses. In other words, change your lifestyle so that you will get the result. It's not a theoretical thing. There has to be some change in the way you use your mind and your senses. You have to learn how to interact with this world in a different way. Now, who here would ever consider such a thing? Would you consider changing your way of your patterns of interaction?
Worth keeping open mind for these things, eh?
Would you consider?
Yeah, I have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Definitely.
Yeah. Anyone else?
Well, you're a bit of a fool, no?
So, our point in our Bhagavad Gita workshops is that if we can just recognize the value of what's being said in Bhagavad Gita and put it into our own laboratory, then Krishna assures you you're going to get the results. But never do you read a text, a verse where Krishna says, just believe. No, Bhagavad Gita is an action book. That's why it's spoken on a battlefield. You can't think of a more active place than a battlefield. Not a theoretical place, a place for theorizing. So, if we put into action what we're hearing, then we get the result that's described. So, Grant, would you agree that that's different from what dogma is?
Absolutely.
Now, whether we want to put into action what Krishna says, well, that's up to each person. At the end of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna, I've explained everything to you, deliberate on it fully, and then do what you wish to do. But then Krishna points out that, let me tell you, if you don't take it from me, the clear and definite information and knowledge, if you don't take it from me, that doesn't mean you're just going to sit there and do nothing. You're going to act anyway, but you'll be acting under illusion. So Krishna tells him, think about what I've said and do what you want, but at the same time, bear in mind the consequences of doing what you like. It's not that you're just going to sit there and be neutral. Impossible. So can everybody kind of grasp that with the way we live our life, we are committing ourselves? We're implicated? Everyone can accept that point? That means there's reactions to your actions. It's not like the world is just waiting. Well, there won't be any reactions for you until you figure out what you're doing. It doesn't work like that. Now, there are reactions to the activity of matter. In school, they'll teach you that. Chemicals have reactions. If you push something, there's a reaction. If you move something, there's a reaction. But Bhagavad Gita is teaching you that besides all that, there are reactions to how you use your consciousness. And that the most intelligent person's always thinking of those things. What are the reactions to my consciousness? That is the most essential part of us. Am I this body, or am I something else? Because you have consciousness, you realize you're something else. Now, what is that something else? To understand all that, the best way is to hear from the Supreme Consciousness, and that's what Bhagavad Gita is based on, giving you a chance to hear from the Supreme Consciousness. So you'd think that everybody would be fascinated with that, wouldn't you? Or maybe. What would you say?
Oh, I think you wouldn't be fascinated with it.
Yeah. But we don't see everybody pouring over Bhagavad Gita. And why is that?
People haven't got to that place yet. Perhaps they will. Hopefully they will.
Alright. We're just going to look at some verses in the 18th chapter. Those of you who were here last week, you know we discussed the modes of material nature. We're going to discuss knowledge in the mode of goodness, passion, and ignorance. Let's turn to page 811. Now, as we discussed last week, everything in material existence is described in Bhagavad Gita as coming in three flavors: goodness, passion, and ignorance. And we read all about the different flavors, and we last week we saw that 99%, 99.9% of the people today are in passion and ignorance. Who was here last week besides Grant? Anyone else? Yes, you remember that? You remember how we all thought we might be in goodness, but then we heard what goodness is like and we realized this is a very high qualification, right? I think you were the ones who thought that, you're one of the ones who thought that automatically you've got to be in goodness, right? Okay, so we're going to discuss knowledge in goodness, passion, and ignorance, because Bhagavad Gita teaches you that all aspects of your life are flavors of these modes, these infections. Either get an infection of goodness, passion, or ignorance, but you are infected. Because as you make your way through life, you pick up contaminations. It's not that you're just going here and there and everything is neutral and cool. No, you're taking on germs. Nature is doing like that. Bhagavad Gita will teach you what nature actually is. Nature is it's full of different winds or currents. And so as you make your way through nature, you're affected by all these different currents. Just like what kind of wind has been blowing the past week?
Some
Yeah, so everything is cold. Similarly, you have goodness, passion, and ignorance, and they affect all the relationships between matter and consciousness in the universe. So, you might say, well, how do you know whether my knowledge is in goodness, passion, or ignorance? You'll be shocked to see how it's quite easy to see. Now let's read about knowledge and the mode of goodness. Text 20 on page 811. Sarvabhute shuyenaikam bhavam avyayam ikshate avibhaktam vibhakteshu tajganam virisatvikam. Who'd like to read the translation? Okay.
That knowledge by which one undivided spiritual nature is seen in all living entities, though they are divided into innumerable forms, you should understand to be in the mode of goodness.
Mm-hmm. Now bear in mind, this goodness doesn't mean perfection. The mode of goodness means the most elevated condition you can get in the material world, but it's still binding. You're still conditioned. You're not on the spiritual platform. But the mode of goodness is very important because it's the first stepping stone to the transcendental platform. You can't see anything straight, the Vedas describe, until you at least come to the mode of goodness. When you're in passionate ignorance, you can't understand anything. And, as we discussed last week, 99.9% of society today is saturated with passion and ignorance. Therefore, even when people talk about so-called spiritual things, they have no idea what they're talking about, because it's passion and ignorance. Now let's read an explanation of what the mode of goodness knowledge is. What is it actually like? Can you read the third part?
A person who sees one spirit soul in every living being, whether a demigod, human being, animal, bird, beast, aquatic, or plant, possesses knowledge in the mode of goodness. In all living entities, one spirit soul is there, although they have different bodies in terms of their previous work. As described in the 7th chapter, the manifestation of the living force in every body is due to the superior nature of the Supreme Lord. Thus to see that one superior nature, that living force in every body, is to see in the mind of goodness. That living energy is imperishable, although the bodies are perishable. Differences are perceived in terms of the body, because there are many forms of material existence in conditional life. Differences are perceived in terms of the body. Because there are many forms of material existence in conditional life, the living force appears to be divided. Such impersonal knowledge is an aspect of self-realization.
Any questions about this? You understand it?
Yeah, sort of.
Okay, I'll explain. This mode of goodness knowledge means you understand there's a spiritual energy which causes life. You're not completely clear what that spiritual energy exactly is, but you're certain that there is a spiritual energy behind all the different forms of bodies. And that knowledge has practical effects. It's not that you just go around in a vague way and say, yeah, everybody is spiritual, the energy, I know there's a spiritual energy. Meanwhile, you know, you're gobbling up the bodies of other living entities. Now, if you actually understand that there's a spiritual force present in everyone, then you change the way you treat all living entities. Now, according to Vedic culture, every creature in the land is considered a citizen, not just a human being. Now, how would that affect the economy of New Zealand? If we considered every living creature as a citizen with the right to be protected. Does that sound unnatural to anyone? to consider all living entities, the sheep, the cows, everything, all of them as citizens. So, according to the standard of Bhagavad Gita, the government does not just protect human beings. Of course, these days, if you can get the government to protect human beings, it's pretty good. But according to the Vedic culture, the government protects all creatures. That is mode of goodness knowledge, because all the bodies are different dresses present in each body. Spirituality, I'm into that. In other words, in the Vedic standard, according to the Vedic standard, there's very little credit given to theoretical knowledge. Your knowledge has to be evidenced in action. That's why in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks about the fire of transcendental knowledge that burns. There's nothing theoretical about fire. Similarly, there's nothing theoretical about knowledge in the full sense. It has to be evidence in what you do. That's the difference you have to bear in mind, a difference you have to bear in mind when reading Bhagavad Gita and dealing with the term knowledge as contrasted with the way Western civilization deals with the concept of knowledge. You've got to show the evidence of your spiritual knowledge in your life. Now, one last point in this sentence, you'll notice that it's called impersonal knowledge because you're not quite clear what the source of this spiritual energy is, and you're not quite clear whether it's the same spiritual energy in everybody or... You're just not clear. You haven't made up your mind completely about it, but you know for sure there's a spiritual energy and you've adjusted your lifestyle accordingly. That means you know you're not the body. Therefore, you don't pursue sense gratification. You don't try to please yourself by pleasing the body because you know you're not it. Now, that is a big change in lifestyle, isn't it? It's one thing to say, yeah, I'm spiritual. Yeah, I believe in reincarnation, all that. Yeah, you just go on and on. That's one thing. But to actually understand you're not the body so that you stop trying to please yourself through the body, that's another level. And that's what's being talked about here, mode of goodness. This is the minimum requirement. Short of this, there's nothing clear. There's just murky, lost bewilderment. So, Krishna in Bhagavad Gita is presenting the mode of goodness as a minimum qualification. Now, actually, the purpose of Bhagavad Gita is to take you beyond. Because even the mode of goodness is a material infection that binds. You'll take another birth, even as a result of the mode of goodness. You'll get a very good birth, but still it'll be another birth. So let's, once again, just like last week, let's keep in mind how exalted, comparatively today, the mode of goodness is. You have definite spiritual understanding, I'm not this body. As definite as you have the understanding that you're not the shirt on your back. It's not anything vague. None of you are vague about the clothes you wear. You don't identify with the clothes. You know, the clothes are just something external I put on. But we are not situated in mode of goodness knowledge until we're that clear about our body and our spiritual identity. At least we have to understand there's a spiritual energy for sure. And that understanding is shown in that we live a life free from trying to please ourselves with the body. Now, what does that say for society today? Everyone's reading a lot of spiritual books. But do we see anybody changing their lifestyle to show that they think they're not the body? Do we see that? When you talk about the higher power, that is a mode of goodness notion. But there's a difference, because the activities may not evidence that there is a spiritual energy, therefore it's not the mode of goodness. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, it's good to recognize that there's a higher power. But what is that power? What you're actually talking about is that there's a spiritual energy beyond the body. That means we're not the body, we are that spiritual energy. But until we change our life so that we stop trying to act like we're the body, then it's not the mode of goodness. It's just the notion we have. Mode of goodness knowledge is born out in action. You understand, there's matter and there's spirit. Since I'm spirit, I don't indulge as if I'm matter. You understand? Now that requires a firm program of activity. This is not just, you know, some kind of, you know, la-di-da. this is the essence of, this is the action.
An action program.
Yeah. Therefore, I was asking you, what do you do during the day? Because that shows you where your conceptions are. All right, let's read about the mode of passion. Knowledge in the mode of passion. I lost 812. Okay, let's turn to page 812. We'll get on more familiar ground now once we head into passion and ignorance. I'll read the Sanskrit, text 21. Pratak tvena tiyaj gyanam nana bhavan pratak vidhan veti saveshu bhuteshu taj gyanam vidhi rajasam. Who'd like to read? Okay, here we go.
That knowledge by which one sees that in every different body there is a different type of living entity, you should understand to be in the mode of passion.
Sounds more familiar, doesn't it? That's what's that saying? What that means is, when you see a different type of living entity in a different body, it means, in every different body, it means you are the body. You have a different body, therefore you're a different person. You're identifying each person as the body. That's mode of passion. Would you like to read the purport?
The concept of the material body is a living entity, and that with the destruction of the body, the consciousness is also destroyed, is called knowledge in the mode of passion. According to that knowledge, bodies differ from one another because of the development of different types of consciousness. Otherwise, there is no separate soul which manifests consciousness. The body is itself the soul, and there is no separate soul beyond the body. According to such knowledge, consciousness is temporary. For us, there are no individual souls, but there is an all-pervading soul, which is full of knowledge, and this body is a manifestation of temporary ignorance. Well, beyond this body, there is no special individual or supreme soul. All such conceptions are considered products of the mode of passion.
Yes, these are all different theories indicative of the mode of passion. You think I am the body, you think the body is the soul, or consciousness is temporary, or we all are the all-pervading soul. All this is mode of passion concoction. Now that's generally what you're going to hear today. Now you see, there's a subtle difference I'll just mention briefly for you. Those of you who are into subtle understandings. You notice the mode of goodness says It's an impersonal knowledge. You perceive that there's a spiritual energy beyond the body. Now you notice in the mode of passion here that you realize that there's an all-pervading soul. Now, there's a difference. The mode of goodness, you recognize that there's an all-pervading spiritual energy, but you don't just say, there's no individuality, we're all just that one pervading energy. But in the mode of passion, you have no experience of that, but you say it anyway. Mode of goodness is open. I know there's an all-pervading spiritual energy. I don't know whether it is personal or impersonal, but I know I'm not the body. There's a spiritual force that's me. That's mode of goodness. Mode of passion, you don't know, but you just say things. We're all one. It is all it. It is all I. I am you. You are me. We're all God. This is mode of passion. Just crazy things you say. You heard people talk like that before? Any questions about this?
Ultimately, if everyone was in the mode of goodness, would our animals exist?
Yes. Why not? They'd probably have a better life, because if everyone was in the mode of goodness, they wouldn't get eaten.
But you're saying animals come around from us being ignorant?
I didn't touch on that today, but the point is, if everyone today is in the mode of goodness, then the animals will not be slaughtered. There's still going to be animals, though, because souls are taking animal bodies. Regardless of how the human beings right now are acting. You see my point? Any other questions? Okay, we'll continue on familiar ground. Mode of ignorance, text 22, page 813. Yatu Krishna Varekasmin Kaye Saktam Ahaitukam Atatata Vrapam Cha Tatamasam Udahitam. Who's going to read? Would you like to read? You have a book? Yeah, text 22.
The translation?
Yeah, I love that part.
And that knowledge by which one is attached to one kind of work is all in all, without knowledge of the truth, and which is very meager, is said to be in the mode of darkness.
Yes, that's actually like what's on this board here, the mode of darkness. Because after all is said and done, what does everybody do? That's what you gotta watch for. After they say this kind of stuff, they don't care if final answers are only discussions and thoughts and sound wonderful and each. What do they do? That shows you what they really think. And it generally is this, and I'm mode of ignorance. So you can read the first part.
The knowledge of the common man is always in the mode of darkness or ignorance, because every living entity is in conditional life. In conditional life is born into the mode of ignorance. One who does not develop knowledge through the authorities or scriptural injunctions has knowledge that is limited to the body. He is not concerned about acting in terms of the directions of scripture.
In other words, he says there's no standard, there's no set of instructions that comes with the universe. Just whatever you think is right, that's what you do.
For God is money.
For him.
For him, God is money. And knowledge means the satisfaction of bodily demands.
Yes. You notice when it comes to sense gratification, people are very precise. you tell them there's a good book that describes how to have better sense gratification. Everybody wants to read it. The men are from Mars, women are from Venus, this, that, the other. Yeah. Oh, definite knowledge. You want to get real specific then. When it comes to spiritual things, oh, it's all vague, it's all formless, it's all whatever. But when it comes to, you know, which movie will you go to tonight? Oh, you're very specific. Which movie you're going to go see? So in this way, by our actions, you see where we're really at. You actually see where our knowledge really is at. It's either passion at the most or ignorance.
Such knowledge has no connection with the absolute truth. It is more or less like the knowledge of the ordinary animals. The knowledge of eating, sleeping, defending, and mating. Such knowledge is described here as the product of the mode of darkness. In other words, knowledge concerning the spirit soul beyond this body is called knowledge of the mode of goodness. Knowledge producing many theories and doctrines by dint of mundane logic and mental speculation is the product of the mode of passion. And knowledge concerned only with keeping the body comfortable is said to be the mode of ignorance.
Okay, so where does everybody think things are at now? Goodness, passion, or ignorance?
In general,
yeah.
In the world, right?
Yeah.
In ignorance.
What do you say?
Yeah, I'd say in general, pretty ignorant to thought of the consciousness. Of it.
Anyone think that there's goodness?
There's a little bit.
Please describe it.
Oh. Well, it's there.
Okay, but can you please describe it?
Well, it's sort of, you know, I can sort of feel it here, right, between it.
Besides here, here is an exemption. It's actually not the mode of goodness here, it's beyond the mode of goodness. That's something else. But anyway.
An exemption?
Yeah, here is special, so. When you're studying Bhagavad Gita, you're not under the influence of the mode of, even the mode of goodness, it's you're beyond that. But give me some other instances.
I guess I'm working with someone like Mother Teresa.
So, in terms of knowledge, how would that affect your knowledge? No. You see, these modes are very specific. That's why Krishna is speaking like this. Just to, you know, it cuts down your room to maneuver, doesn't it? That's, you know, the modes in Sanskrit, they're called gunas. Guna means rope, cords that bind. So as soon as you understand that in all your thoughts, your work, your determination, the food you eat, your conceptions, they're all products of these gunas or ropes, then you really see what's going on. So it's not like, you know, there's some nebulousness. It's either this or it's that. Just like on a highway, you're either driving in this lane or that lane. So, please, you give an example of how there is mode of goodness knowledge.
I know
what happens. See, most people, they start thinking about this word goodness. Irrespective of particular symptoms. You know what I mean? So you just hear the word goodness and you start thinking, yeah, there's some goodness in this world. But when you hear the standard given in Bhagavad Gita, it really helps to ground us, you know? You know what I mean?
That's a city thing.
Anyone else who sees some goodness?
Those people that, you know, Christian Children's Fellowship and that sort of thing, people that are trying to make a difference, a positive difference in the world, I suppose you could call that good.
So what does that mean, make a positive difference? I mean, those are good words, but what is, now, if using the using the handles you're getting in Bhagavad Gita, try to get a handle on a positive difference. What's that mean? You have a better self-esteem? Do you think better of yourself?
Or? Rather than acting selfishly, acting selflessly for the good of other people. Trying to give other people a chance in life. And
a chance to do what?
A chance to have the same opportunity as everyone else. And
what is that opportunity?
To live.
Any creature has an opportunity to live.
Well,
at least before you kill them and eat them. But any creature has an opportunity to live.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about those kids in that places like Zimbabwe that don't have the same, the food resources and the less medical resources and sort of thing.
Okay, all right. Fair enough. After they get the food and medical resources, then what do?
They, suppose they'll continue to live in the mode of ignorance.
Hey, you're pretty smart. So what's changed, really? From your point of view, you might say that you helped them live a bit longer, but nothing else has changed, has it? Because if you're actually in the mode of goodness, you know that the soul cannot be killed, so their existence is eternal anyway. But the problem is, because we think we're the body, we have no experience of our spiritual identity, even though we may talk spiritual, the soul, eternal, this, that. We actually don't have that experience because we lack the experience and the knowledge. We go on doing the same as everybody else. Suppose you were hungry and I said, oh, I'm going to make a positive difference, positive change. I'll give you the same opportunity that I have. I'm going to treat you to a wonderful steak dinner.
I'll be happy. Yeah.
And what about the cow? You see? So where's the mode of goodness? Why would you be happy?
Stomach would be full, I'd be living.
Full of what? Full of what?
Full of food.
What kind of food? Describe it.
I'll see you point out.
No, describe it. Your stomach is full of what?
Steak.
Which is what?
Meat.
Be more specific. Flesh. Of a dead body. So you're happy because your stomach is full of pieces of dead body. You wash it down with some beer, right, or some wine, right? Full of flesh. Pieces of corpses in there. Eat rare. Well done, rare. And that makes you happy, right? Because you can feel this. Belly's really poking out, It's got onions on it, make it real pungent and spicy, right? And you're very thankful. Oh, this steak, thank you so much. You thank the cow, too? I know you're a happy cow for giving yourself in this way. Sometimes you go to butcher shops and you see they have a sign out with a happy cow's face. Do you ever think like that when you? So would I be doing you good to do that to you? Huh? Now from the Vedic standpoint, I would be responsible for implicating you in bad karma. I would get a karmic reaction as well as you. Both you and I would be guilty. Just like, on the street, if the police catch me giving you some drugs, you take the drugs, but I gave it to you, we'll both be liable for criminal charges. We're both implicated. And then what will the police try to find out? Where did I get the drugs from before I gave them to you? And then they'll try to find out how the drugs were manufactured or who brought them into the country. And this way the police will look for the hole, ideally. They're probably taking it themselves, but ideally, they'll look for the whole network. So that's the way the law of karma works. Everybody involved gets a karmic reaction. But you thought it's good. This is really goodness. My belly's full of those pieces of flesh, medium rare.
Is it good, though, in the respect that you can define this?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the fact that he may be an example of someone in the mode of ignorance or whatever, is it good in the respect that you can point this out as an example to show to other people? Is that good?
If you teach the science of Bhagavad Gita, then you are beyond the mode of goodness. And the one who studies Bhagavad Gita is also beyond the mode of goodness. That's a special thing. Mode of goodness is impersonal spiritual knowledge. Bhagavad Gita is beyond that. You learn that beyond your impersonal conception, everything is simply personal. Just like a person can be impersonal. You want to, you can treat somebody impersonally. So similarly, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that he has an impersonal spiritual appearance, which is supposed to go beyond. So when people talk about higher force or higher power, that's impersonal. Just like suppose I'm looking at you and I just, you know, there's a power there. Josh, you came from a power. There's a higher power. Now, how would you feel about that?
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, you say, hey, wait a minute, I'm a person, I'm me, I'm an individual. You know, you're a higher power. May the power be with you. How would you feel? I mean, you can't talk because you're just a higher power. How would you feel about that?
Well, I would feel pain.
Yeah, okay. So Krishna says the same thing in Bhagavad Gita. He's offended. In other words, you have personal things about you. And I should get to know that if I'm going to talk about you. I shouldn't just brush you off. It's a higher power over there. See that behind Josh? It's a higher power. You see the point?
Yeah, I see the point.
Yeah.
But then give me are you talking personally about my description of what I said before?
No, I'm just, we're just talking. Any questions? You've been pretty quiet all the way back there. Now, if we were going to consider making a change, what would we do? Hearing what you've heard about the ignorance, passion, and goodness, if we were going to consider making a change, what would we do? Any suggestions? What kind of knowledge would we try to develop?
To
what? To who you are, what your program is.
I guess that's what's sort of important to have realization about.
What kind of knowledge do you feel your life is involved with?
relationships.
Let's try to use the... This is why it's good for us to do this. Using what we just discussed about passion, ignorance, goodness, what kind of knowledge do you think your life's involved in? Otherwise, you can really start tripping out, you know, relationships and the higher powers and the this and the that. And just using the model of goodness, passion, ignorance.
Campaigns called exactly what Bill did. Yeah, but
take a stab and we'll help you. Why would you choose ignorance?
Because I know that I just do not know anything.
Well, that knowledge by which one is attached to one kind of work as all in all, it means, you know, it's my job is every day, I just got to get the money, I'm just trying to pay the rent, put some food on the table, have some good pleasures, hey, don't bug me about anything more. It's more of ignorance. Therefore, the purport says, the quote-unquote knowledge of the common man is always in the mode of ignorance or darkness, because every living and any conditional life is born into the mode of ignorance. You don't develop any particular knowledge through standard spiritual texts. You're just concerned about money and satisfying the bodily demands. Does that sound too severe? Now, how do you fit the relationships into that? You mentioned the word relationships. I know it's a very hallowed word these days. Relationships. Now, what actually happens in those relationships? We just talked about his steak dinner. Now, we'll get specific. You know, with you, what happens in the relationships?
I have some actions and reactions.
Yes. And generally, what kind of actions and reactions?
Generally, positive or negative ones.
Let's be specific. Give an example of a relationship.
Man's relationship, food.
Okay. Now, in Bhagavad Gita, food is described in three categories, goodness, passion, or ignorance. Now, food in the mode of ignorance, that is decaying flesh. Food in the mode of passion is very spicy vegetarian food, very hot, lots of chili and onions and that kind of stuff, but it's vegetarian. And food in the mode of goodness is naturally sweet, very healthy, very nourishing for the body and the mind. So the relationship with food, that's also the three modes. You see, the three modes cover everything. It keeps us from, kidding ourselves. That's why it's a good thing to read. Even charity is in three modes, goodness, passion, ignorance. To give someone meat, thinking you're helping to feed them, and it's good charity, that's known as charity in the mode of ignorance. You have no idea what you're doing. Just like if I give you poison to drink because you're thirsty, without knowing it. So it's not that you can just give... You see, according to the standard of Bhagavad Gita, you can't do anything without precise knowledge. And we don't like that, do we? We feel, you know, in life you should be able to kind of just, you know... And should be vague, you know, so you can have lots of room to, you know, space out, you know, and make your own blend, you know, and make your own reactions too, and make your own system, be God. That's why it's good for us to study these three modes, because we see how everything is prescribed. We don't like that, though. And that's another symptom of the mode of ignorance, that we refuse to accept that there is an ultimate standard. Suppose when you were raising Josh, yeah, he's 5 years old, and you tell him that He can't run out into the street in the middle of traffic. And suppose he tells you, "Well, Dad, there's just no clear and final answer." It's just the wonder of each moment. When I'm running in between the cars, I really feel that wonder. What would you say?
I believe it.
He probably was. Anyway, what would you say?
Oh, well, I'd have to impose authority.
Impose? I thought there's no fear in final answer. Oppose a thought, impose. Why?
For him, there isn't. But for me, there is. In my relationship with him.
Oh, you see? Things really get definite real quick now. And what gives you the right to impose your authority upon him?
Because that's the way I thought.
But that shouldn't be, it shouldn't be that way?
Well, at the time, I didn't know any different.
So if you had a 5-year-old kid now, you'd let the kid do whatever he or she wanted to do?
No.
What would you do? You still impose your authority. Why?
Because that's the way I think.
So ultimately, when it comes down to it, we do recognize there has to be a standard. But as long as we make the standard, it's okay. As soon as the standard comes from somewhere else, it's dogma, it's restrictive. But if we make the laws, oh, they're quite all right and quite good.
Well, there are plenty of other instances like you can admit, but it's a matter of ownership of these things. Some of these things you can take up ownership on them.
And can you give me an example?
Well, you go down the road. So you go out for the evening and get into a discussion with somebody, an argument develops before you know it, the tempers are cleared beyond the point where you can't control yourself, and you assault the person, and then you walk away from them. Later on, it's only later on that you begin to disown your part of it, and that you feel that I didn't do that, I shouldn't have done this. This wasn't normal to me.
Now, you may make that mental adjustment, but does that mean you've actually tidied up all the reactions to the situation?
No, it hasn't. But what it means is if you've taken ownership of the situation and you're prepared to accept the consequences of it. It's when you don't prepare yourself to accept the consequences of the situation.
Now, who decides? How do you get? Oh, let me put it this way: how do you get an overall view of what all the consequences are?
You don't. You only deal with the immediate concerning yourself and your actions.
And how do you, just in the world as you see it, how do you get a handle on all the consequences? Just like if you decide to feed this hungry young man here, you gave him a steak dinner. That'd be all right for you?
I'd have to ask him whether the steak will offend him or not.
Oh, not the cow! You see? Well,
theoretically, the cow's already dead.
No. Oh, so it's... Okay, so... Let's say, we'll kill a person and then decide what to do with the person's property, and because the person's already dead, it's like, it's out of the question. The person's out of the question.
No, I wouldn't do that.
So my point is... How do you get a grip on what all the consequences are? Even in the small area of your life, or the small area of my life?
Well, I don't. This is what I'm saying. I can't get a grip of what all the consequences are. I can only get a grip of what the consequences are immediately affecting me.
But I just gave you an example. If you give him a steak, isn't that an immediate consequence affecting you? You've just taken part in the web of animal slaughter.
Yeah, if I believe that it was wrong. If I didn't believe it was wrong, I don't see that I have just taken part in a crime because I have not, in my own beliefs transgressed.
Oh, so if I come to your house and burn it down, it's all right because I haven't accepted that in my mind as a crime. How would you feel?
Oh, I feel really upset. What happens to you is not my concern.
No, but I haven't accepted it as a crime, so therefore, you know.
It is a crime.
But in mine, it isn't. And I'm dealing with my consequences.
So I'm saying, and the person who I'm giving the steak to, if they feel it's a crime, then I wouldn't give it to them. But if they did not feel it was a crime, then, and they wanted to eat it, then they are quite welcome to eat it.
So, if somebody thought that, you know, you giving them drugs was not a crime, and you did it.
If I was participating in their culture.
No. Then would that be a good excuse for the police? That he didn't think it was a crime, so I gave him the drugs.
Well, doctors do it every day.
I think in every relationship or interaction, there's a feeling of taking. And depending on the giver and the taker, what their personal response is towards that situation, there's a right and a wrong for someone.
Now, who decides the right and wrong? This is where you differentiate between knowledge and passion, ignorance and goodness. Who lays down the standard?
The standard is laid down by the Supreme.
And what is that Supreme?
Well, depending on how you think about Jesus, it could be God, it could be Krishna, it could be...
Whatever.
Whatever.
Yes, I like that. That's what I like most, the whatever.
So you take your standards from what you think or feel or whatever is the right thing to do at that given moment. And if you do not do the right thing to do, you'll know it inside that you have done the wrong thing.
How do you know inside? You get a sour feeling in your stomach?
Yeah. Your stomach starts chewing. That's a physical indicator. There's also another indicator inside you, your whole being sort of quakes because you know you've transgressed and stepped over the line.
So I'll give you the same example. I'm just using it as an example. So when you bite into a steak, do you get that sour feeling in your belly?
With me personally? No.
Why not?
Because I don't feel that I am taking someone's life unnecessary, or eating flesh for me is wrong.
Alright. So, okay, my point though is, it probably is very highly inaccurate to just go by our feelings like that. It seems that if, as you say, I didn't say it, you said it, that there's some kind of supreme or whatever, we've got to really get some definite knowledge, otherwise we could be just really stumbling in the darkness, you know?
Yeah.
So that seems to be where we should be heading.
Yeah.
Let's get some specific knowledge of this supreme whatever. Because as you say, the law is actually laid down by the supreme whatever. So we better get some specific knowledge, right?
Yeah.
So therefore you see that these modes of nature, goodness, passion, ignorance, they're very specific. Because things are, in every case, very specific. Any final questions? Now, what to do? What to do?
Are you going to tell us how to take on this elevated consciousness thing, then?
I'll leave that to your mate here. No further questions? And you, Mr. Relationship, what will you do?
How important is it to have a spiritual master in your life?
Well, let's look at it this way. learn something, isn't it the quickest way to find someone who knows and learn from them? That's true even when it comes to fixing your car. You have a computer? Well, you know that nobody's paid to have a friend who knows about computers, right? Or maybe you're the one who knows a lot and you're, I don't know, your friends call you up, is that the way it is?
No, that's not the way.
Yeah, but you have a friend who, it doesn't work. So you're recognizing that there's an authority that can solve things quicker than you, right? Now, if that's so in terms of ordinary mundane things, how much more it's true in terms of inconceivable transcendental things? When it comes to knowledge beyond the range of your senses and mind, the only way you can get information is through hearing from an authorized source. If you want to understand New York, I'd say, I would take it you haven't been to New York. So the best way to learn, because it's inconceivable to you, you haven't been there, is the best way to learn is to hear from somebody who knows about it. Similarly, to get knowledge of what lies beyond yourself.